Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Swim podcast. All right, swimmers, how's it going? Welcome to episode number 17 of the podcast, Someone Who Isn't Me. My guest on this one is Laura Jane Grace, singer and frontwoman for the band Against Me. And when the band was over in December, they were doing a bunch of UK dates. We also recorded a session at Maida Vale for my show, which was brilliant. I hope you got to check that out. I'm sure somebody's ripped it by now, so it's probably on YouTube somewhere and you should have a listen. So anyway, after the session, I recorded this episode of the podcast with Laura and we spoke about the album Shapeshift with me. We also spoke about her book Tranny, Confessions of Punk Rock's Most Infamous Anarchist Sellout, which if you haven't read, you should definitely pick up because it's wicked. So we spoke about all those things, also about being a parent, touring in a band, a little bit about some mystical chit chat as well. I think it's a really good one. I enjoyed it a lot. So I hope you do too. Check it out. This is Laura Jane Grace.
Last time I spoke to you was when, just after the last record came out, wasn't it?
Right, yeah.
That was such a, I had all these not preconceived ideas about what this new record was going to be like. I just, you know, I had real hope for it, which have all been met.
You
know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Because that the last record, as I said to you when it came out, it was like, I think it's my favorite punk rock record in years and years and years.
Thank you.
Because of everything that's in it, and I think the songwriting is amazing. And it's not like the songwriting wasn't great before, because it always was, and that was the thing that I think that's so great about the band. It's so consistently been brilliant. But that record, because of everything that was on it and the subject matter and the way you were going through it very publicly, it imbued it with so much power.
There's definitely a difference with making that record than with previous records, you know, specifically like coming to terms with identity while writing songs, as opposed to, like, you know, even on the record before White Crosses, of feeling like searching for identity, you know, or specifically because you're like denying identity, looking in the wrong place. So, you know, there's definitely like a difference in the songwriting and in the approach to songwriting.
Yeah, because that's something I wanted to ask, because do you find that the whole creative process is a different thing now? And I don't mean that because of you transitioning. I mean it in the sense that, because now, whereas there would be, looking back in hindsight, they now feel like almost veiled references to things that you were struggling with.
It's, you know, every record's obviously going to be its own experience and takes place at a certain time and place in your life, so it's hard to judge them against each other in that way. You know, like with your first record, you have your whole life to write your first record. And then the second record's like, you know, notoriously referred to as like the sophomore slump, right? And it's hard to judge with the most recent record specifically, just because it was a real different experience, because I was writing a book at the same time. So that was like the first time ever making a record where there wasn't pressure on songwriting. Like, I could have very easily have just occupied this whole year by just writing a book, releasing a book, and doing the publicity around a book. It was like that.
That's very underselling it, though, as well. Just writing a book. Just.
Well, you know what I mean? Like, that could have been my year, and it would have been like, okay, cool, you were still working, you were still there, everything. But I think the reason there was a new Against Me record was because I was doing that. And for the first time ever, like, the pressure was off of songwriting. So that just became like the excuse in this way of like, okay, I've, you know, I've got something due right now. I should be working on this. My editor wants a couple chapters, but instead I'm going to pick up a guitar and I'm going to fuck around for a second and I'm going to like put that off and procrastinate. And so much of writing a book was about reflecting on the past and thinking about things that had happened and how I felt about that. So consequently, writing a record then became like, I just want to think about how I feel right now. And then knowing too that there was like a certain amount of pressure, or not pressure, but expectation, where, you know, some people, I definitely like not trying to pay attention to what people thought, but I was aware that some people were like, oh, what is everything going to be trans this, trans that now? And then some people even happy at the thought of like, oh, cool, everything will be trans this, trans that now. And my reaction was just kind of like, you know what? I just want to write dumb love songs. Like, I want to go, we're going to tour, I'm going to have crushes, I'm going to fall in love, have relationships, and I want to write songs about it.
Yeah.
And I don't care what anybody thinks, I just want to do that.
That's awesome, that.
Yeah, it was great. And it, like, made it easy, you know?
Yeah, and it's almost like writing your first record. You've got your whole life to write it. And also, the agenda for writing your first album is generally very different from the others, because as soon as you're a band which has had a long career, it becomes a career, right?
Right.
So then there is that pressure in sure. that sense, because then it's like, I have a mortgage and I need to do this and I need to pay for that and blah, 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 blah.
Sure. Or like, you know, with like our fourth record, the pressure was like, okay, it's the major label debut, you know? Or
yeah.
the second major label record was like, oh no, this is our last major label record. This is the last shot type of deal. So again, it's like different pressures with everything yeah. you do. And like the pressure with Transgender Dysphoria Blues was, there was still pressure, you know, but it yeah. was like a self-imposed pressure in a lot more ways.
Yeah.
But this record was different. It was like pretty effortless for the most part, you know, and especially as a band too.
I think it really sounds it as well. It feels like, I don't know, probably, but it's a tough one, isn't it? Because everybody views art is one thing, like visual art is, unless it's very abstract, it's pretty much spelled out for you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, here's the narrative. This is what this is about. This is, you know, you're taking it in. But with music, it affects you because it depends on where you are. When you first hear a song, what you're going through in your life. So you obviously then take on all this stuff and start interpreting music through your own... I don't even know what I'm saying. I've lost my train of thought.
No, but that's context.
Yeah,
yeah. yeah.
So, uh-huh. yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
So that record for me, Transgender Dysphoria Blues, for me was, it had so much with it that had so much gravitas, and you can really feel it. And then this record, it feels like, it feels, you know, there's really dark moments in it. I'm not saying it's like fucking happy, happy, joy, joy all the way through.
Sure.
But there's moments where it's just really beautiful and light.
Yeah. I mean, that's reflective of the experience that was
yeah.
being had, you know, like and this is the first record in a long time where there's like literally like first takes that were recorded that are on there, or like wrote the song, played it three times and then hit record and there it is, where like
wow.
those moments to me are like the moments you really strive for, where it feels like okay, that was magic, you know, that like
yeah.
just happened and it was effortless and it just was captured.
Yeah. Because that's what it is.
Yeah,
I very much so believe that. As you know, before we started, I think that's exactly what writing music is, and making art of any type is, opening yourself up to things and letting things sort of make themselves aware to other people through you. That sounds really like pothead talk, though, doesn't it?
Yeah, but don't worry, I'm a pothead, so it's fine.
You know, I think a lot of people would probably. That sounds like a kind of kooky idea and probably struggle with it, but I that's how I think. Even if I was writing 3-minute chipper pop songs, do you know what I mean, it still comes from somewhere,
right
and that's you know, a lot of people would take offense to that, because a lot of people would be like, no, I wrote these songs and it's all because I'm a fucking genius. there is the degree of that, obviously, because I think to be able to tune into those things and make those things happen and to write a great pop song is a fucking huge achievement.
But do you think that's conscious or subconscious? Because most of the times, like for me, meaning with art doesn't reveal itself until after. Mm. And oftentimes, like, my first impression of the meaning will be wrong, and it'll be years or, you know, years later where I'm like, oh, or maybe that's just changing.
It does change, you know? Yeah.
And maybe that, I think, is the sign of, like, a really good song, is if it does survive and it changes with you as you grow and yeah. you get new meaning from it. If something's limited to just a time and a place, I feel like that's a sign of weakness of art, you know?
Yeah.
yeah, at least in my experiences.
Yeah, that's very true. Do you find that then? Do you have songs now that that kind of reveal to you things that either initially may have missed or you interpreted in a certain way, and now it's like, oh, that's...
Sure, yeah. And you know, songs that remain relevant to you as you grow. Like, it's an amazing thing to have a song you wrote at 17 years old still be relevant or still feel relevant at 36.
Yeah.
And some of those songs are, like, you know, more direct in their reinterpretations. Like, for instance, the song Pints of Guinness Make You Strong. You know, like, I wrote that song about my grandparents, and my grandmother's name is Evelyn, and then I named my daughter Evelyn. And for me now, you know, that's a song that we've played every single night pretty much as a band. And in the past, every time we'd play it, I would think about my grandparents. But now when I play it, I think about my daughter, who, you know, if I'm on tour, chances are I'm not coming home to that night. So it's strange how that works out.
Yeah. That's a tough thing as well, isn't it, touring as a parent?
It is, yeah.
I really struggled with it.
Yeah.
Especially, like, when I had my son and he was very young, because kids change so much, especially in the early days, I would come back and I'd be like, who's this guy?
Yeah, well, you really see those differences.
Yeah, yeah. And he probably was exactly the same.
Right. It's a trade-off, you know, for sure. Like, yeah. It really, like, places more importance on things for me, too, where I'm like, okay, what am I doing here? You know, is this a waste of my time? If so, like, it's more of a waste of my time than it used to be in the past,
yeah.
when I was just wasting my own time anyways. Now it's wasting my time that I could be with my daughter, if it is. You know, the trade-off is that when I am home, like, I'm home. And I've been on tour now for, like, since September, basically. And I have all of January and half of February off, which is nice. So, yeah. like, I'll just be there every day. And every day, you know, it's like such a complete polar switch of lifestyle, where when I'm home, I wake up at 6 a.m, get my daughter up, make her breakfast, take her to school.
Yeah.
I hang out at my studio until 3, and then it's time to go pick her up. And then we go back, we go to the library, you know, make dinner and go to bed and do it all over again. And then you go on tour and it's different. It's
somebody's
nice.
Somebody's waking you up.
Yeah, yeah, totally. And then it's like, oh, I gotta stay awake until 10. We're not playing till then. That's usually when I'm in bed. Yeah. I mean, you know, she's gotten to see the world, though.
Yeah.
And she's already had the touring experience. And that may not be something that dawns on her yet, but I do think eventually she'll be appreciative of that and realize, like, not every kid has this experience, you know?
But yeah, my son was exactly the same. That you know, he was coming to festivals, riding the bus, and that was just the norm,
right.
So, and you know, this is Dave Grohl, you know.
Yeah, and they're like, yeah, whatever, big deal.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Right, he was stoked, actually, because he was like, you played the devil in the Tenacious D video. But that was what he was most excited about. But and it's now that he's realized, and it wasn't like, you know, I don't think the kids that are brought up that way, through good parenting, I don't think they take it for granted.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
But they suddenly have that moment, and you see it where it dawns on them, where they're like, "Oh wait, this isn't how it is for everybody."
Right. Yeah.
And that's quite a beautiful thing.
Sure. I think that might be like one kind of disconnect that I think dawns on them later as a kid is like the idea of like, this is what you do for a job and how you make money to buy groceries, right? Eventually, every kid realizes that like money is a factor in your parents' work and they make money from that. So when your job doesn't necessarily seem like a job, I think that maybe it takes them a little while longer to put those dots together, you know?
Yeah. And so it's such a weird thing, touring as well, because it becomes so insular, doesn't it? Do you find it hard to decompress after touring?
I do, yeah.
How long does it take you? Is it a few days?
For sure. You know, I mean, mostly like usually like a week to get back into like a normal routine, you know. It's just such a like, you go from a state of constant stimulation, you know, of like meeting new people every day, going to a new place every day, and really like having a goal-oriented day of the show. You're there to play a show, and good or bad, once you do the show, you've accomplished the goal for the day, you know? And then you take that away, and all of a sudden you're like at home, and you're like, what am I doing? Like, where is everybody? No one wants to ask me questions today. Or like, you know,
I can call you up.
it's stark, you know, it's bleak.
Do you struggle with it?
I do a little bit, but it's like, you know, it's strange where I feel like I've crossed the threshold of turning back in that way, where all of a sudden, like, your life just becomes that 24 hours, you know, 7 days a week, all the time, of like, this is what I do, this is who I am, you know, like, yeah. And on the road or off the road, it's still who I am. And it's just like a change in schedule that happens when you get off the road. But I still, like, I, you know, a day after I'm off tour, as long as it's not on a weekend, if my daughter's in school, I still go straight into my studio. I pick up my guitar. Yeah. I practice songs. I practice guitar scales. I warm up my vocals 100%.
Wow. Yeah.
And it's just making sure you stay in that groove, you know? And
yeah.
A lot of that might be too, because like at this point, like being gone all the time and being in a band, I've had to make social sacrifices to where I have no personal life, that it's always just that your band is your life, you know?
Yeah.
So maybe that has something to do with it too.
It's bizarre, isn't it? Because most people think, you know, when people that aren't within it and aren't or playing bands that even might not be touring bands, they just think it's all glamour and you're doing this and you've got so many friends and you're seeing the world. And it's like, you know, invariably you could unless you make a conscious effort to it, you could do a world tour and see nothing other than a bus, a venue, and a hotel if you're lucky.
For sure. Yeah.
And it's such a weird thing, and it's easy to get trapped in that bubble.
Yeah. I mean that's something I think about a lot, especially like having toured for a while, of like, you know,
a while,
like, you know, 20 years or so touring, like coming to a place of realizing, okay, I need to be appreciative of going to these places, and like feeling bad sometimes when you've been to a place multiple times but not seen anything really, you know? Like, I was thinking about that last night as I was falling asleep. I was like, how many times have I stayed in this hotel? And what, you know, like, have I ever done anything really touristy when I've been in London? And I was like, no, I don't think I have, you know?
Yeah.
Anything I've seen has been just like coincidence of like, oh, there's Buckingham Palace, so we're driving by right now on the way to do some press or something like that. But of wanting to be appreciative of places, you know?
Yeah. I imagine that there's a ton of press now as well. Wait, is it more now?
It is, yeah. Uh-huh. No, it is what it is, you know? I've been actually thinking about how I'm going to break it to my publicist that I kind of don't want to do press anymore.
Yeah.
Like, just, I need a break, you know?
Yeah.
Like, for mental health reasons and just, like, for... I think it's a positive thing to, like, you know.
Yeah, of course. It is a weird one, and I do apologize because I realize I'm very much part of that.
No, but I like you, and I'm happy to talk with you, so it's all good.
Thank you. But
yeah. Conversations are also a different thing too than. I guess it's like not even wanting to not do press. It's just like wanting to make sure it's worthwhile press. You know, like sometimes you're just like, why am I talking to this person? And what, like, everything you're asking me, you can just Google it. You'll be able to find it, you know, like write the interview yourself.
Yeah. It's funny. I saw, saying of that, I did actually look at a couple of interviews and there was a really funny thing that I saw you say about, like doing press in Germany that whole thing of like, I liked your last album, it was very good, but this one is shit.
Yeah. And you're like,
I had that a bunch.
I think it's obviously some kind of language difference.
It's like a
cultural
thing, I guess.
Yeah, totally. And something's being lost in translation where they must. Yeah, I really do hope. Yeah, but it's like sometimes it's literally just not a question. It's just like a not even thinly veiled insult. It's just an insult, you know?
Yeah. Bizarre.
I remember this is funny. We were doing this interview, me and Adam, and it was like German press. And Adam was trying to tell a joke, and he's like, you know, he's like, there's this zoo I went to, and there was only one animal in the zoo, and it was just a dog. It was a shih tzu. And, like, the journalist is like, I've been to a zoo like this. Like, It's like totally lost humor on them.
Yeah. So a bit more about the album, because I think, you know, the thing is, I don't know if you're the same, but probably not actually. But when I get an album, I kind of have to have a few listens, because the first listen is literally like my analytical mind is pulling everything apart, even though I'm trying not to. I'm trying to just enjoy it.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And it's only after a few listens where you can kind of shut that down a bit and just enjoy it for what it is.
Sure. I'm the same.
Yeah?
Yeah. But I also like...
What, just pulling songwriting apart in that sense, or...
No, you know, I just I digest things in a way of, like, I get a record, if I love the record, I will just listen to it to death over and over and over until I have digested every part of it, you know? And then, like, I need to walk away from it, and then I need something new, and I need to move on. And it's rare that I'll have an album that, even if I love, love, love the record, that I go back too much after I've done that, just because I'll listen to it to death.
Like, literally, like, wrung everything out of it.
Yeah, and it's like, okay, wow. I'm done with that. I've gotten what I want out of it. I've, like, learned the trick of whatever it is that's doing it for me.
Well, that's what I mean. That's what I was interested in, because you're a great songwriter. I think I was curious to see if you kind of dissect things a little bit and work out, oh, I love this song, why do I love it?
Sure, totally, yeah. And it's like, it takes you a little while to realize, like, is it the meaning of what they're saying that's hitting you? Is it like the vocal delivery? Is it the melody and the combination of the two? Or what is it that's hitting you about this song, you know?
Yeah.
And it's always different.
Yeah, I was going to say about the whole thing about... So, for me, when I first listened to the record, the first track, I read it wrong, so I didn't see it as Provision.
Right.
I was like, Provision. So I was like, what's this about? And I'm like, I need to know what this is instantly, and I'm like this. And then...
Did it come up?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
And now, every time I've been to an airport, it's all I can think of.
It's like free advertising.
It's amazing.
Getting the body scanners on board, yeah.
But that's it's really powerful, because it's such a everything that it insinuates is so creepy.
Right. Well, you know, it's intentional too in a lot of ways. Like, I realize that it's kind of like an odd song to start off with, being that it has my friend who's Japanese doing like a however many seconds long Japanese talking intro.
Yeah.
And then, like, it's the one song on the record that's like really directly in your face political. But it's a song about an airport body scanner machine. So the record was written on the road, traveling, touring. So you're starting off in the airport and you're like disoriented. But then also knowing that, like, if there were any expectations of what the record would be, that intro would totally confuse everyone at first. And then, like, you'd have the fresh start after the song ends to go wherever you want it.
Yeah. Did it feel like, I mean, you've said that, you know, obviously you were working on your book, so therefore there was less pressure to make this in the same way that you've had before. Did that feel like a fresh start, especially as, because of that last record was almost like, it was a fresh start, right?
Right. Yeah. It did, and it feels like, in a way, like detached from the other records. I mean, there it is.
Which does
Shapeshift.
Okay.
Yeah.
How so?
Like almost in a Rogue One type way. Like it's still Star Wars. Hopefully, this is a good thing. I haven't seen the movie yet.
No, me neither. I've got very high hopes, though.
Yeah. It's still like in the canon, you know, but it's like a different line of the story, you know.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah, maybe that's why it feels slightly different, because that's how you view it.
Right. Well, and it's, you know, it's the first record proper with Adam and Inge, you know, like,
yeah.
And the whole attitude behind it was about being open to collaboration, you know. Two of the songs on the record I wrote with my friend Cody. And I'd never branched outside of the band as far as collaborating with writing with anybody before. Even having my friend Machichko, like, sing on a song, you know, that was like just trying to get whoever wanted to contribute something into it, you know. And
why do you think that is now? Why is it that you can do that?
Because the record before was such a closed experience where I, like, absolutely needed full control of it, you know, for multiple reasons. But I wanted this to be different. I wanted to invite things in as opposed to like putting up defenses.
Do you think it'll be that way from now on though? Do you think that Transgender Dysphoria Blues was that point now where it's almost, I don't want to say like laying out a manifesto because
sure.
Do you know what I mean though?
Yeah.
Like it's like here is everything. You know, then you did the Rolling Stone interview and all of a sudden that whole world blew up, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which I can't even imagine, to be honest, how much stress that was.
Right. I had a fucking nervous breakdown like a year and a half later. I totally lost it.
Because all of a sudden it's like you're inadvertently taking on the mantle of a whole group of people.
Right.
That maybe didn't have so many figureheads before and no one, you know.
It was a lot of pressure.
Yeah, fuck yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought about it the other day and it just feels like to have something that you struggled with your entire life and then get to a point where you're like, here is everything.
Right.
So it's you fully accepting everything and moving forward from that point and all of a sudden it's like everyone's like, yes. You know, here's somebody in the public eye that is saying exactly how we feel, but to have not been really part of that world.
I don't mean that
to sound like I'm being a dick.
No, but that's
but do
accurate.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. Like it was stepping into a situation where like all of a sudden you have the pressure to have everything figured out, especially because you're doing interviews and you're aware, regardless of whether you want to or not, be representative of other people.
Yeah.
But you're aware that it's representative of other people and that, you know, that you're accepting something about yourself, but at the same time you can't possibly have it all figured out, you know?
Yeah, of course.
It was just like unrealistic in some ways to carry on the way I was carrying on, you know?
Yeah. Wow. Was there a backlash against you from that community?
Or was
everybody, I imagine, I'd love to think that everybody's super supportive.
Sure. I mean, I think that, you know, there were definitely like parallels that I was able to like realize between the punk scene and the trans community in ways, you know, kind of like it's more the internet crowd specifically, you know. But then I did definitely like receive some flack for the title of my book specifically. So, I mean, that is
In what sense? Because of the word tranny? Or?
Yeah, because of the word tranny. Yeah, just like based on the title alone. I really recognize that some people wanted to like disassociate from me or like saw it as like a sellout move, you know, which was like, it was easy to spot though. And it like having gone through it before, it was like, okay, I get what's happening here and I understand this. Mm. And, you know, it doesn't affect me the same way it did when I was like 24 or something like that, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's really powerful, isn't it? Like it's so funny how, it's not funny at all, but it's so weird how a word can carry so much weight. And I'm all for the whole reclamation of words,
right?
But are you using it in that way? Did you deliberately say I'm calling the book this because I want this to be a word that we can reclaim, or is it not at all?
No.
Yeah, because it's a horrible word,
right? Yeah, totally. But recognizing that there's power in the word to me is like automatically intriguing. Mm. Any word that someone's like, you can't use this word, to me is like, oh, well, that's an interesting word then, you know, like,
yeah.
Just as an artist, you know, and I don't like being dictated to in that way as an artist in any way. But it was a word that like used to hold a lot of power over me. And so in like wanting to kind of break that power from the word, you know, that was part of it. Not in a reclaiming it as like, I want to be identified in this way, just as like, I want to destroy the power this word has over me. And anytime anyone were to use it towards me now, I'm going to think of my book, you know, like that's it. And that's a different thing. And then, you know, the first time it was used towards me, was by another trans person. And it wasn't in a derogatory way or anything like that. It was just in a friendly, joking way, you know, referring to me as a tranny. And I was like, it stunned me because I had been so ready for it to be said as an insult, you know, that I was like, how will I react to this? I need to prepare myself so I don't like immediately just like fucking punch somebody. So I was like taken back by that happening. And it's interesting too, like I did the panel a couple weeks ago with Kate Bornstein. I don't know if you're familiar with her. She's a trans author. Okay. And she's way older than me. I don't mean that in like way older than me. She's just older than me, you know, like by a couple decades, and definitely part of a different wave of transgender people. Hmm. And we were being introduced to us and we're standing in this hallway and someone said something about the title of my book and how Kate doesn't have a problem with that word. And Kate was like, and neither does Laura, blah, 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 you know? And I was like, well, actually, like, I don't really like the word and I do have a problem with it. And she was like, well, do you know the history of the word? And I was like, I guess I don't. And she's like, well, trans people invented that word, specifically Australian trans people. Australians have a tendency to shorten every word.
Yeah.
Barbecue becomes Barbie. Transsexuals became trannies. And so it was a word coined by trans people. And it's definitely turned into a word that's like become a hateful word.
Yeah.
But it came from trans people. And so it was an interesting thing to like feel like you're kind of in the middle of two sides where you have an older generation of trans people being like, this is our word. We invented this word. You can't tell me not to use this word. I've been using this word forever. And then you have the newer generation of trans people being like, you can never say this.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This word, I don't care if you're trans and saying this word, just never say this word.
Yeah.
And then you're in the middle like, well, I just want to call my book it. I don't know. I see both sides. I see the validity to what each of you are saying, but yeah, I don't know. What do you do in that situation?
How was it making a book? Because it's it strikes me as being just such an all-engrossing, I was going to say grueling, especially because I mean the book is, you know, it's really, really open.
It's the opposite of ego building. it's not like you come out on the other side feeling really good about yourself or like accomplished or like, yes, I can't wait for people to read this. It was like feeling totally kind of deconstructed as a person at the end of it and kind of devastated in a way, especially because it's a memoir, you know, of looking at it and being like, okay, that was me, you know, that's the life I lived, that was what happened. And it just takes a lot out of you, you know, it like really, I feel like I aged like at least a decade over the last year alone, you know.
Yeah. What was the schedule for writing? Because I got a really good book recently called Daily Rituals.
Mm-hmm.
And it's everybody from, I don't know, like P.G. Woodhouse to Nikola Tesla to like all these people that are either renowned scientists or authors or artists, and it's just like a chapter and it will be they would rise at this time and they would sit.
I love reading stuff like
it's
that.
It's great. Yeah. I almost brought it for you, but I haven't finished it yet.
Yeah, no, I've seen a couple of other similar things with writers specifically where it breaks down like this was their drug they used and this is when they were tended to be like most creative between these hours or this was their daily schedule. And I used to like even try to emulate some authors with that stuff, you know. But
that's the thing, isn't it? Magic is one of those things, like or creativity, let's use that word.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's so different for everybody.
Right. And it is really particular to you. You can't just steal someone else's like style shtick, in that way. Yeah. although maybe like you can be like, yeah, speed worked for them, speed will work for me. No, but like I've always find that I'm most creative in the mornings or late at night before going to bed.
Yeah.
But it's a different kind of creativity, a different kind of feeling with each. But a lot of this, because I had like my day job happening too, of being in a band, and much of it was like done on tour. There was that, but the last year of it, this past year, you know, was mainly like working on it pretty much like, you know, wake up in the morning, take my daughter to school, drink a cup of coffee, and just start working on it, you know, and work until it was time to pick her up. And we'd usually go to the library, and there's like a nice children's area at the library where she has friends that she'll play with, and I would work on it a little bit while she did that, and then we'd go back, make her dinner, she goes to bed, and I'd work for another hour or two, and then just go to sleep myself. So it was really just like every spare moment during the day.
Was it something you fell into quite easily, writing? Because you've always kept journals, because there's a lot of journal entries in there as well.
Sure, yeah.
Which tie in, and it makes the whole thing flow.
Well, honestly, like the book, even the narrative parts are just pretty much from the journals, where you take a chapter from or a paragraph from the journal and figure out how to reword it so it flowed as narrative. But it's still just directly from the journals, pretty much. In that way, like, unfortunately, a lot of the process wasn't very creative. It was more just transcribing and like, you know, rearranging words. It wasn't like, I need to come up with a thing here. I need to come up with a part or something, just because it was, you know, it wasn't about remembering. It was about...
So you were going back through all these old journals?
Yes.
And how was that? I bet that was mildly traumatic.
It was, again, depressing. Yeah, traumatic, depressing. You know, it's just there. And it's like, that's your life. And those are like page after page.
How long have you kept them for?
Since I was 8.
Wow.
I was like, my father lived in Italy at the time. I was a military brat, and he had to do a training exercise in Germany, and I was going to be out of school for a little while.
Yeah.
So my teacher gave me journaling as an assignment, told me to keep a journal on the trip. And it was a really like impactful trip. I was 8 years old, and my parents took me to Dachau concentration camp. So at 8, trying to understand like who the Nazis were, what fascism was, and what happened there, what the Holocaust was like hard to wrap my head around, you know? And then also my little brother got hit by a car. He was hit by a truck, like ran out into the street and was pinned underneath the wheels. He was 3 years old. His bones were really, you know, like young bones, so they didn't break and he was fine. But nonetheless, like as an 8-year old writing about these experiences, processing them, I didn't realize that's what I was doing, processing them, but I was. And I got a really good grade on the journals when I came back, and just like kept going from there. I lost pretty much. I still have that first journal, but like everything up until I was like 14 or 15, I lost just because I wasn't keeping for posterity. You know, I was just like throwing it away as I was going or whatever, moving, you know. But I had everything from when I was like 15, 16 until now. So it was like, you know, it literally took me a year and a half to go through and transcribe everything myself.
This is like, must be like crates and crates then.
Yeah, totally. And that was part of like the impetus for wanting to do it even was like, I have all these boxes of journals that anytime I've moved, I've had to find a new place to store and also like store in a way where to like be hopeful that whoever wouldn't stumble upon them, you know, like a babysitter or something like that.
Yeah.
So it was like, well, even if I want to keep them and I don't want to burn them, but like at least getting them out there would mean that no one could go there and like read something that would be damaging to me or like I don't want shared. I'll just go ahead and share it before anyone can take that away from me.
Yeah. You know? I kept one when I must have been probably about 11, 12, and I hid it. And it was under a... So, like, I worked out that I could take a drawer out of my chest of drawers and, like, underneath I could put it in and then you'd feed the drawer back in.
Right.
And I went away. I think I went to stay with a relative for, like, a weekend or maybe a week. And I got back... And it was gone, and I mean, you know,
panic.
Of course, yeah. And that was, and then I got like a talking to, or not really, like an awkward. You need to speak to him. One of those, which was horrendous. And I think that was the reason why I stopped keeping them.
See, but, I had the habit too of doing like just from writing a lot while traveling, and also knowing that I was like leaving these journals in my bunk and stuff like that as I was going on the bus. Like, I would sometimes write really outlandish, untrue things, like, tonight I'm going to kill everyone on the bus, just in case like someone read it, you know, to make sure that they wouldn't read it again. So it was fun going through and like seeing those moments, you know.
Yeah, and you're gonna burn them.
Yeah, I was advised by lawyers at Hachette to hold on to them for a period of time. So I was like, okay, I'll hold on to them. Just because, like, they want to be able to make sure that, like, if for any reason someone would be like, are they really from journals, that you can produce the journal and be like, yes, here it is, in writing in the journal. So I've held on to the journals for the time being.
Wow.
I also had the realization, having the intention to burn them, I was like, wait, I fucking live in an apartment that doesn't have a fireplace. Where can I burn these journals?
But then you can make more of a thing of it and actually make it a ritual.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And do something with it.
Journal burning party.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's yeah, but you could do you paint?
I don't. I, you know, I used to do like cut and paste stuff, you know, like type of artwork.
Yeah.
But I never have had like a real ability for drawing or like or painting or anything like that, you know?
Cuz I've burnt, without going into stuff too much, I've painted pictures of people. Mm-hmm. That's really horrible. Painted pictures of people and then burnt them and then used the ash and mixed with other paint and made other paintings.
Wow.
Which sounds crazy.
No, that's amazing.
Yeah. So I was just curious because, yeah, you could, I mean, you could make something with them.
Yeah.
That's I get this, idea. I have this lady that writes to me at work. Mm-hmm. And I'll get one, maybe two letters a week. And I'll show you some pictures. And it's, she's got real mental health issues, but I've kept them all because I think I'm gonna make a huge collage and then I want to paint a picture of her on the top. But yeah, I think that there's something you could make out of them that would be quite magical.
Yeah, yeah. So, I've been for like, maybe it was kind of inspired by the book and I don't even realize it, but for the past couple of years I've been in a process of like getting rid of everything, like not wanting to have attachments in any way, like of a physical kind. And I'm not sure when I'll feel like that's enough to where I can start to regain things again. Yeah. You know, we're talking about like a desk or a rug and stuff like that, but like really wanting to minimize everything. I don't know. I don't know if that's related to journaling or like putting it all together in the book of like leaving the past behind and starting a new chapter.
Yeah.
But I feel like I'm in this like perpetual state of waiting for the past couple of years for that next thing to happen and for to be able to move forward, you know?
Yeah.
That now that the book's out and it's only been out like less than a month, you know, like I'm kind of trying to figure out what the next thing is or like where does life go from here, you know?
But then, yeah. But then you've also collated all these things and kind of decanted it almost into the book. So it's almost like they're now, yeah, you can move away from those now because you've taken all the parts that you want, maybe.
Sure.
Is this something you want to do much more of now, writing then?
I do, yeah.
But what do you think? Do you... In a biographical sense, more of that, or
I wish I were good at fiction. You know, I know like people say that no one actually writes fiction anyways. It's just like the truth kind of twisted around, and maybe I just need to learn to do that better.
Yeah.
But you know, like before doing the book or anything like that, I was always taking whatever writing opportunities came my way that had nothing to do with songwriting or whatever. Like, for a while I was writing record reviews for Relics magazine. Anytime some kind of like keep a tour journal assignment came, like I would jump at the chance, you know. And for a while I was like doing a blog that was just like random writing stuff, just because I wanted to develop that ability. And maybe that's a little bit of like thinking to the future of like, I won't always be able to get up on stage and sing in a band, you know, and I need to do something once my hearing's gone that, you know, like is still artistic and has like something to it like that. But I've always wanted that, you know. I've always wanted to be a writer.
Yeah. Have you thought about that then?
What do you mean?
In the sense of like, what am I going to do when when my hearing's gone or whatever.
I have, yeah. No, I have for sure. Or not even like hearing specifically, but like when your body can't take it anymore, when I can't tour anymore or whatever, like, or if my band breaks up or like, you know, the next chapter.
Yeah, I get that. And I know people in other bands that I've spoken to that have said sort of similar kinds of stuff and like, oh, I can't be, you know, especially bands that are like, I don't know, like Dillinger, for example. Mm-hmm. When I spoke to Ben, he was like, you know, I'm not going to be, I can't keep doing this. I actually can't keep doing this physically.
But they're one of the most physically fit bands anyways, but yeah, go ahead.
But then it's like, it's not like you're ever going to stop writing songs, are you?
Sure. No, I don't intend to, I don't plan on it. You know, I want to be able to keep doing this for forever.
Of course. So,
I don't know. I don't know what it is. It's just like a, it's the same with, like, you know, I've been taking, like, producing gigs for bands the past couple of years. I guess it's, like, a little bit, too, of is a feeling like the more you branch out and try different things, the better it makes you at this other thing, you know? Mm. Like, and that was what journaling was for me always, too, or, like, part of the reason I really kept at it. You know, it wasn't just getting a good grade when I was on an assignment when I was 8 years old. It was that I could only write lyrics for so much time a day. And I wanted to have writing habits like I'd read of other writers. Hmm. So I needed some other form of writing to be able to occupy my time. So it became like, just write down the mundane fucking things you did today. Like, woke up, made breakfast, did this, did that, good day, end, you know? Yeah. Or sometimes it was even just like writing something over and over and over again, just like to be writing, to be physically in the act of writing was always important to me.
That's interesting. Because, do you think that then that because then that affects what you're taking for songwriting, for example, and
sure, mm-hmm.
even if it but that's interesting about the actual act of physically writing,
not even what you're writing about, just a pen on a paper and the strokes and the movement of it.
What in a kind of hypnotic kind of trance like way?
Sure. I mean, again, like, you know, even sometimes not having anything to say. Like, I always had a couple fail safes of like, okay, if I have nothing to say, I will just like, I'm an atheist, you know, like I'm not a Christian in any ways, but like the serenity prayer is something that I was always drawn to. And I very much also believe that like prayer is basically just like spell casting anyways, right? Of course. So like writing the serenity prayer over and over and over again for just pages and pages and pages of like, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference, over and over and over again. When I was like going through a hard place in life or whatever, I always found to be really therapeutic and really good.
Yeah. Wow. To say that you're not not a religious person, but you're definitely a very spiritual person, right?
I am, yes. Mm-hmm.
And I think that comes from being an artist, and I think that those two things definitely go hand in hand.
Sure. And I also feel like that I've experienced moments on stage that are definitely like different than your average moment in life. Of where you're like transcendent moments. Tell where me. Like time moves at a different pace.
Yes.
And you can just, you have a different state of awareness, you know? And it's like, I tried to write about that a little bit in the book of like just, but it's hard to capture in writing, you know, of like your body is absolutely pushed to its physical limit. You know, you're breathing as hard as you can, sweat pouring out of every pore in your body, and like surrounded by a deafening wall of sound and like faces, bodies around you. It's like just, it's like the closest church I'll ever be, you know, or closest to church that I'd ever like to experience in a good way. I don't know.
Yeah, and I think that in a performance sense like that, when you're making music with other people and it's almost like there's a circuit, and then there's the circuit of the audience as well.
Sure.
Which again sounds a little,
but it's, no, but it's absolutely
100% true. I think, you know, there is the energy is a palpable thing, and it does, yeah, things can change.
Right, and I definitely like, you recognize that difference, especially if you had this experience of playing with multiple different people in your own band, you know, of being like, this is the connection I had with this drummer. This is the connection I had with this drummer. And for me, it's always about the connection with the drummer and where it goes from there and like the way you can react to that. And I've had relationships where it's like, 100% psychic, where they can tell what you want and you can tell what they want. Yeah. And you don't have to communicate anything verbally. You just know where to go with the song. And then I've had relationships too where it's like, oh, well, this is shit. You know, like, this sucks. Like, we can't do anything really with each other. It's really more about, like, spelling it out of, like, play this beat here, you know? And I don't like that. I want it to be, a transcendent experience. You
yeah.
know?
And is when those moments have happened where it has been like, this is just not working. Has everybody sort of realized that and gone, okay, or have you had moments like, have you struggled through?
Yeah, there's definitely been times where you struggle through, where you're like, okay, this is what we're doing, you know, and it's good enough for now. But at the same time, those setups, like, I feel like the audience gets that. They can pick up to it, you know, up on it, you know, even if it's like the same on paper, where every part was still kind of played the same and should sound like the same song. And it does sound like the same song, but it's not, you know, like there's something missing. And that's the like unhearable part or this unseeable part.
Yeah. I had an interesting conversation with Scott from Neurosis. I've said about this a couple of times actually on the podcast, where he was saying that when they were right, because they felt like one of those bands where I could go straight in on that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that when they were writing music and everybody was perfectly in tune with it and each other, there was more than the sum of the band members' voices within the room.
That's a great way to put it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people, even if people don't want to acknowledge those sort of things because they think it sounds pothead or kooky and like, I don't know,
right,
hippie or whatever, however they want to view it, you can palpably tell the bands that have that though.
Right.
Right?
Yes.
And I think that's why bands stand out from other bands because there is this extra component and an extra... there's something mystical going on,
right,
is the best way of putting it, I guess, and the easiest way of saying it.
Totally. And that's why, like, you know, I've talked a little bit about this before, but, like, I really think that, like, modern recording fucks with that, where, you know, with, like, Pro Tools recording,
yeah,
of whatever it is you can't hear that's in a recording, if you're cutting it up and putting it together in different pieces, that thing that your body can still hear and process, even if you can't tell you're hearing it, you're aware that it's like mismatched or disjointed and something is not connected. Yeah. So even if on paper it's like, yep, stayed on beat, all the guitars are in tune, sounds good, but that thing that's like unrecognizable is destroyed.
I never thought of it like that. That's really true. That's why a lot of that being cautious of what I'm saying. That's why a lot of things that are worked in that way can feel soulless.
Yes.
Because there isn't that flowing through it. I never looked at it like that. That's so true.
Yeah.
Because if you're going to, you know, if it is a thread that runs through something, in that, if you imagine it to be that, and then you start cutting that thread up and moving it around and sticking bits of the same thing over the top of itself.
Right.
Yeah.
And you're never you can't even pay attention to if that thread is lining up with the other thread.
Yeah, because
you're just
it's
lining
an unseen
it up.
Thing.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Wow. That's just blowing my mind a little bit because I never thought of it like that. Maybe that's why, yeah. Why a lot of stuff does feel soulless.
I think it is, you know?
Huh. That's a great point. Sorry.
No worries.
I kind of wish I could just...
Me too.
So on that note,
uh-huh,
if you don't want to talk about it, then fine. But, right, you smoke weed, right?
I do, yeah.
And there have been times where I know that you've said, like, growing up in Florida that drugs were pretty rampant.
Yes.
So have you found that... certain ones, I'm just curious. Have you found that certain ones...
Certain drugs? Or
yeah.
Uh-huh.
Actually facilitate those moments that feel magical?
I do. I mean, but I'm not necessarily sure the reasoning for that. I've never found, like, cocaine or anything like that to be something that facilitates that.
Yeah.
Alcohol, too. although alcohol sometimes, like with the physical show experience, can doesn't hinder it. I'm not sure if it necessarily like is a necessary part, but it doesn't take away from it.
It almost removes a few, like there's less inhibition, I guess.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But what I like about smoking weed specifically is that it can give you an immediate scene change. And oftentimes, like with being in a band, you need that. Like it's if this were like, you know, an hour before a show or something like that, that we were talking right now, you know, once we were done, I'd need an immediate mind change to get into, okay, now I got to do this. Yeah. And sometimes it's hard to do that, you know? And so sometimes if there's like that hour window to be creative during the day, if I smoke weed, then it like is immediate reset button and I can focus on the thing I need to do. And then I can go on to the next thing. And maybe some of that too is like, you know, is dealing with anxiety issues, you know, and dealing with whatever mental issues. Having been told by therapists before that, like, oh, you need to be on serious drugs. You need to be on antidepressants. You need to be on this or that because of whatever you're dealing with. And I've always refused. And like finding that smoking weed seems like such a better alternative to pharmaceuticals.
Yeah.
I don't see the damage in that. I don't see the wrong in that, you know? And with this record, you know, like with the last record, that was a big part of it was like, you know, we are all spread out as a band. So we made the record in Michigan where Mark, our front of house person and tour manager, lives and has his studio. So you sleep there, you know, there's lodging for the bands. So waking up in the morning and it's like, you know, maybe it's February and there's snow outside everywhere and you're in the middle of the woods. You wake up, you have a cup of coffee, smoke a joint, write a song. Then you go pick up your guitar and just start playing and record the song right then and there. Yeah. Like those were moments that it's not like they're foggy. I can still remember everything, single thing about them, but they were really like, for me, creatively facilitated by getting stoned first thing. You know?
It must be a liberating way of working as well, because in an age where people tend to overthink everything, and I don't know how you are, but like, when writing, especially, so you write songs, and then prior to this record would be, here is the song, here's what you do, here's your part, this is the bass line, I want you to do this, I want you to play this drum beat, right? Is that
for the most part? Yeah, most part. It felt like it was like with the band, it progressively became that more and more and more each record was that it like got to be that way.
Why do you think that is?
Some of it was like
was it you, do you think?
Yeah, totally. A lot of it was me wanting that kind of control. Some of it was like a lack of motivation on other band members' parts, you know, like in just that the relationship was burnt out. And so they're just showing up because they got to show up, you know?
Yeah.
But like, I don't think there's anything wrong with having a real specific vision for something, you know?
Yeah.
And sometimes like that's the that way it is.
Didn't mean that in an accusatory way. Wow, you sound really power mad. Yeah. I didn't mean it like that.
You must do this. Yeah. But like, you know, sometimes you just have this vision for, I want it to sound this way.
Of course.
But like also with, you know, with Transgender Dysphoria Blues, like I played bass on those songs.
Yeah.
Except for the songs that Fat Mike played bass on. And he did come up with his own parts on that, you know, like those are his parts, his ideas. But this record, again, I just wanted to be different. I wanted it to be collaborative in that way. You know?
So do you think that now, so how do you think that will affect things moving forward then? Do you think you'll take elements of that on board or what? It's too early days to say, I guess, right?
I like, when it comes down to it, I'm never going to be like comfortable with the idea of anyone else writing lyrics in the band.
Oh, of course. It's just, yeah, I can imagine that would be.
Yeah, it like has to be my voice and my thing that's happening. You know, it's a little too late in the game to like hand over the reins in that way to someone else. But if James wanted to write a song, he can write a song and as many songs as he wants, and we'll put them on the record. Yes, and I'd be happy to play them. I don't know. Like, I don't think at this point, having had this experience now, that it can go back to the other way. Just like from the way the four of us work now, if we aren't all equally contributing and present in the room, I don't think it'll work. It just like kind of has to have that engagement just because everyone is the way they are.
Well, that's great though, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And I think it's really like arriving in a place where everyone's on the same page. Like everyone is doing what, like, everyone knows why everyone else is doing what they're doing. It's not like a, why are you here? Or like, are you planning to cut and run in a second? You know, or like, do you have these other career ambitions? Like, everyone is a lifelong musician. Everyone has been in other bands. They've like all been through the major label experience. Like everyone's had that same thing and knows why they're there in a good way.
Does it feel like a long time coming that you've got to that point though?
It does. I mean,
do you look back on it now and look at it that way?
I do. Yeah. I mean, it feels like that was what we were working for, or I was working for, me and James were working for, or like, I don't know. It also, like, I don't know. I don't want to diminish like other incarnations of the band in any way, because like they were all important in their own ways. But it felt like each one kind of met its limit of like, okay, this is how far this can go. And I think oftentimes like, well, that's what ends bands, is like you reach this point of like, well, this is what we can do. This is like the extent of our musical abilities. So it's, in a way, it's like cheating of like pushing what you can do musically by just changing out players. You know, like, okay, now we can do totally different things. Not because we've learned different things, but because we are different people. But that's it. I don't know. It's a good thing.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's an hour.
Cool.
I don't want to take up any more of your time, but I mean...
I appreciate it. It's been cool talking to you.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Well, thank you. I think we're good, right?
Yeah.
Thank you for Laura for taking the time out to record that episode. Also, thanks to Emma for helping facilitate that and make that happen. And again, also thank you to the rest of Against Me and crew, because whilst we were recording that episode, if it feels like it finishes fairly abruptly, I don't think it did. It sort of reached like a good point to conclude, but Laura's phone started blowing up because the rest of the band and crew were all waiting in the hotel lobby to go and eat. So apologies for that. If you don't have the new Against Me album, Shapeshift With Me, that's a terrible thing, because it came out in September and it's wicked, so you should own it by now. Also, Laura's book, Tranny, Confessions of Punk Rock's Most Infamous Anarchist Sellout, is out now as well. You should definitely pick it up, because it's a brilliant read and I really enjoyed it, so I think you would as well. If you get a minute after listening to this podcast, you could go to iTunes if you want and leave a nice 5-star rating and a short review. That would be brilliant, because it does actually make a difference and I'd really appreciate it. The next episode of Someone Who Isn't Me is going to be with Dan Searle of the band Architects, and we're going to record that next week actually, so it might be up a lot sooner than some of these have taken, because I know the gaps between the episodes takes forever. That's partially because I got a lot going on, and also because I made the stupid rule of painting a portrait of each person who is on the podcast, and that takes a minute, so yeah, I apologize. But the next one with Dan Searle should be up quite...
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Soon. All right, thanks for listening again. I'm out. Peace.